Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast. In this episode, The Devil's Alliance, Roger Moorhouse discusses Hitler's pact with Stalin, 1939-41, with moderator Robert Gervarth. Recorded at the Printworks Dublin Castle on the 24th of September, 2016.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Wonderful to see such a large crowd here. It's my great pleasure to be in conversation this afternoon with Roger Moorhouse, the author of a wonderful new book, The Devil's Alliance, Hitler's Pact with Stalin, which offers numerous intriguing new perspectives on a seemingly familiar topic, not least because he shifts the emphasis somewhat away from Germany and includes a Russian perspective, but also includes very astute observations about what it meant to live under Stalinist occupied, Russian occupied Eastern Europe at the time. Roger Moorhouse is an internationally acclaimed historian, particularly of modern Germany in the period of the Second World War, but he's also written about Central Europe, Poland in particular. So he's a long-standing expert in the history of this period. And before we start our conversation, Roger will give us a brief overview of some of the key arguments presented in his book.
I will. Wonderful to see so many of you here. On the 23rd of August, 1939, the day that the Nazi-Soviet pact was signed in Moscow, Stalin raised a glass of Crimean champagne with Hitler's foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, and drank a toast to Hitler's health. He referred to Hitler as Maladietz, as a thoroughly good chap, and he said that he appreciated how much the German people loved their Führer. We forget, perhaps, that opening chapter of World War II was one where Hitler and Stalin are working in conjunction, in concert. I think there's a tendency, certainly in British historiography, I'm not sure what, if there's a specific Irish historiography about Central Europe in World War II, and if so, I apologise. If I say our historiography, I'm talking from a British perspective. But I think we generally forget about this opening phase, the opening 2 years of the war, effectively, 22 months, in which those two dictators, whose later conflict, whose later clash, defines World War II in Europe. That is the defining conflict in World War II. But I think we tend to project back and imagine that Stalin was always on our side, was always against Hitler. In 1939, he is not. In 1940, he is not. And that was a main point of this book, was to try and hammer this point home, that Hitler and Stalin are effectively in alliance between 1939 and 1941. So it's 22 months. It's one of the most salient points, one of the most salient chapters in the history of World War II is the Nazi-Soviet pact and the alliance, the relationship that grows out of it. And yet, we have collectively forgotten about it. It's not part of our standard narrative of World War II. And it's my conviction that it really should be. It really should be front center in that opening phase of World War II. There are various reasons why it's been forgotten. But to give you a couple of examples, if you picked up, for example, Anthony Beaver, whose work I very much admire, has written various books on this. He's written a single volume history of World War II. That has perhaps half a dozen index references to the Nazi-Soviet pact. Doesn't have a chapter, doesn't have an extended discussion of its provisions. If you look at school syllabus, for example, my son's just done GCSE history, and his history syllabus tells you that the Nazi-Soviet pact was the last sort of chess move in the diplomatic chess game that leads up to World War II. That's the only part where it comes into the discussion. It's purely a diplomatic exercise. It doesn't lead, in that narrative, to 2 years of German-Soviet collaboration. It doesn't lead to fully four economics treaties, a further two political treaties between the two. It doesn't lead to the secret protocol by which the two sides divide up Central Europe between them. That is completely erased from the record. It's not part of the discussion. As I said, I think that we really should be trying to insert this history back into our understanding of World War II. You often hear the defence that the Nazi-Soviet pact was just a non-aggression pact, just a non-aggression treaty, like the many others that were signed in the 1930s. And at first sight, if you look at the text of it, the text of the Nazi-Soviet pact, which is only 7 paragraphs, it's about 250 words, it's very, very short. It's a very anodyne text, and it is just yet another non-aggression pact. But the devil, there's that word again, the devil is in the detail. There is, of course, as some of you will know, the secret protocol to the Nazi-Soviet pact. That's where all the juicy stuff is. That's where they divide up, they literally draw lines down Central Europe and say, you have that bit, we'll have that bit. The fact that these were all sovereign nations they were dividing up didn't matter. So the defense that this is just yet another non-aggression pact doesn't wash. This is the opening of a 22-month relationship between Europe's two, the world's two, greatest, most nefarious, most wicked totalitarian powers. The relationship between Hitler and Stalin, from Hitler's perspective, is more important than the relationship that he has with Mussolini. It's not an alliance. I use the word alliance in the book in a sort of metaphorical sense. It's not an alliance, but it is the most important international connection that Hitler has in the opening phase of the war, without question. So, let me just, before I sit down again, let me just talk a little bit about why this is, in a wider sense, why this is important. And Robert alluded to this just now, talking about actually trying to put the focus in Central Europe and say, what did this mean for the people of Central Europe? I talk about it in various ways. I talk about the grand diplomacy. I talk, for instance, about what this meant for the communist movement worldwide. This was huge. The fact that Stalin decided to get into bed with Hitler, someone who he'd been, both sides had been abusing each other in fulsome tones for most of the 1930s, that they then turn around and sign this agreement between them, this was grounds for suicides amongst people in the communist movement. It was that big. It was a humiliation for the communist movement worldwide. I would argue it's as big a humiliation as 56 is, as 68 is, and ultimately as 1989 is. So it probably should be mentioned in that category of communist failings. But to put the focus back onto Central Europe, if you say, why is this important? Why does it matter? The easiest way to answer that question is to say, ask a poll. Ask a poll why the Nazi-Soviet pact matters. You'll probably find someone whose ancestors were deported, were one of the perhaps 1.5 million Poles from eastern Poland deported by the Soviets to the wilds of Kazakhstan and Siberia, for most of whom that was the beginning of an odyssey across Asia, across the Middle East, often into Africa, and sometimes, if they were lucky, to the UK. Ask the Baltic states what the significance of the Nazi-Soviet pact was. It opened 2 generations, 3 generations of occupation, annexation, and again, deportation to the wilds of Siberia. The only bit of relief that the Baltic states got from Soviet occupation was 4 years of extremely nasty, brutal German occupation in the early 1940s in World War II. So it opened an entire Pandora's box of horrors for the Baltic states as well. Ask the Finns what the significance of the Nazi-Soviet pact was. It meant that Finland was silently consigned to the Soviet sphere of influence. It meant that Finland was declared war upon by Stalin and invaded. And what followed was an extremely brutal, if mercifully short, winter war through the winter of 1939-40. You cannot understand the World War II in Central Europe, how it played out, what passions were unleashed in that region without understanding this chapter, without understanding that there are not one devil at play, but two. So that's a very brief introduction to what I tried to do with the book.
Thank you very much, Roger, for this great introduction. I think we'll start with a couple of questions for me. One of them, and something that struck me even before I started reading the book, was this very unlikely alliance between two mortal ideological enemies was obviously something that was difficult to sell to the party rank and file. For many, many years, in the lead-up to the outbreak of the Second World War, the Nazi followers in Germany or communist supporters, not just in Russia, but actually across Europe, had been told that the Nazis or the Soviets were the mortal enemy. So suddenly, out of nowhere, the negotiations hadn't been publicized in any way, shape, or form. Suddenly, an alliance had been forged. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how the Nazis, on the one hand, but also Stalin in Moscow, managed the backlash.
Yes, that's a very good question, and that makes up, I think it's chapter 5 in the book, looking at that precise question. I said that in the wider communist world, you know, the Nazi-Soviet pact provoked suicides because it's that sort of counterintuitive to a communist mind. The short answer to your question as to how both sides sold the pact to their own followers who, of course, they had been, you know, they both effectively built their careers as a counterpoint to the other, particularly Hitler. You know, Hitler's anti-Bolshevism and the anti-Bolshevism of the Nazis is absolutely a red thread that runs right through Nazi thinking, Nazi ideology. It's everything that the Nazis were in the 1920s and 30s. And then for Hitler to turn around in 1939 and say, oh, by the way, I've made a pact with this chap who 6 months earlier was the devil incarnate, took a lot of selling. And the short answer is, on both sides, they didn't really try. It's quite interesting. It was sold as, you know, a variation of the Führer principle. The leader has made this decision, the leader knows best, and we have to suck it up. We have to like it or lump it. It's interesting that on the day after the Nazi-Soviet pact is announced, the front courtyard of the Brown House, which is the Nazi Party headquarters in Munich, was reputed to have been littered with the party badges of those Nazi Party members who were unhappy at this arrangement having been forged. And that gives you a taste of what the sentiment must have been. In the Soviet Union, it's rather different. There is a much greater sanction available for anyone that decided to publicly contradict Stalin. It was a much more perilous situation, so people didn't tend to do it. But still, there's a tremendous popular confusion, and people are saying, you know, in their sort of local, their Communist Party meetings or a meeting in their workplace, they'll be saying to the representative of the Communist Party, so, well, how do we? What is going on here? Why are we suddenly, you know, being nice about the Nazis, being nice about the Germans? And they did actually try in the Soviet Union. They do set up these sort of information points in various salient places around Moscow in the big cities and send people out to the workplaces. And they tried to sell it. But they realized fairly quickly that it was too hard to sell. It was too hard to make sense of to the ordinary Soviet Communist Party member. So they just stopped. And they had to rely on, effectively, that sort of the force of politics. That this is how it is. Don't question it. Just get on with things. We told you that black is white, and you have to get on with things. So they did a brief effort to sell it, but both sides really found it almost impossible. So that dead weight of propaganda over most of the previous decade was still hanging over them. And for both sides, peculiarly, once you get to 1941 and Operation Barbarossa, particularly the Germans, there's a great diary quote that's often used from Goebbels, where Now, when Operation Barbarossa is launched in June of 1941, the attack on the Soviet Union, and Goebbels says in his diary, "Now I feel totally free. You know, the burdens of the last 2 years have finally been lifted." And I think that's quite instructive, that he felt that he was always living under that burden of having to be nice about the Soviets. And then in 1941, suddenly he didn't have to do it anymore.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the personal relationship between the two protagonists? I mean, Hitler and Stalin obviously never met. So it's Molotov and Ribbentrop, the two foreign ministers, who negotiate the arrangement, obviously, under strict instructions from their masters. Would you describe their relationship as amicable, or is it...
That's a very good question. The two, as you say, Hitler and Stalin never met. They did correspond, and in sort of relatively friendly terms as well. Molotov came to Berlin in November of 1940, which is one of those strange chapters which, if you don't sort of read the Nazi-Soviet Pact in the way that I do, which is as a sort of a genuine political arrangement, it's not just a sort of spasm of collective bad taste in August of 1939. It's not just that diplomatic chess move argument. It actually is a relationship for 22 months. If you interpret it in those sense, then it makes sense of why Molotov goes to Berlin in November of 1940. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. So he does, you know, Molotov does go to Berlin. Ribbentrop, of course, goes to Moscow twice in August and then in September of 1939. There's lots and lots of lower-level contacts, particularly between economic emissaries. They had four economics treaties between them in this period, the last one being January of 1941. So there's an awful lot of lower-level contacts. But there are, you know, there are a good few meetings between Ribbentrop and Molotov, both of whom are, even in the rogues gallery of Nazi stroke Soviet history in World War II, they are two of the most unpleasant individuals you could possibly imagine. And I think also, I would add, two of the stupidest individuals to ever hold high office in any country. Ribbentrop is someone who is, the word that always springs to mind when I mention Ribbentrop is oleaginous. He's oily. And that's always the word that comes into my mind. He's an oily individual. He's sycophantic upwards, and he's cruel downwards. So he's a thoroughly unpleasant individual. He doesn't seem to have ever had a sort of a genuinely original idea of his own. Even the idea for the Nazi-Soviet Pact doesn't come from Hitler, interestingly. It came from the German Foreign Office, which there were a group of very clever people, what we would now call mandarins in the German Foreign Office, who had long been advocating, they were known as Easterners, and they had long been advocating some sort of arrangement, economic and political, with Russia. And this goes way back, you know, way back beyond the formation of the Soviet Union. So they'd always advocated this. There's, you know, Germany needs Russia's raw materials, and we need their political consent to take over Central Europe. We want Central Europe, and we need to have them on side to do so. So there's a long game going on in the German Foreign Office, and this sort of comes to a head in 1939. The idea is put to Ribbentrop, as I said, has never really had an original idea of his own. He parrots the same thing to Hitler, and things move on from there. So the progenitor of this is the German Foreign Office. So Ribbentrop certainly takes the plaudits for this, but it's not his idea, and he's not a terribly bright individual. He's a salesman. He had been a salesman before his political career. Again, it shows you the sort of calibre of people that some of whom who reached high office in Nazi Germany. Ribbentrop had been a champagne salesman or sect sparkling wine salesman, and he was propelled to high office because he'd travelled a bit. He was quite a good sort of speaker. He could negotiate. That was the background that he took into being initially German ambassador in London and then German foreign minister. So it's quite a remarkable background. Molotov is no less unimpressive. basically a journalist, had been the editor of Pravda, was very much Stalin's thing, Stalin's creature. Doesn't seem to have ever had an idea of his own. His own wife was later sent to the Gulag by Stalin. And when he complained, Stalin said to him, "Don't worry about her, we'll find you another wife." This is the way things worked in the upper echelons of the Soviet Union. So it's a very brutal environment, and it's one in which mediocrities like these two can, under certain circumstances, rise to the top. They become the people that put their names to the Nazi-Soviet Pact, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. But they are effectively a pair of non-entities. And they are. What's interesting is that they are the creatures of their masters. And this is one aspect that comes out quite strongly, is that in both cases, in the Soviet case with the removal of the previous foreign minister, who had been Litvinov, who was someone, again, an old Bolshevik, but he was someone who had his own opinions and had a track record, and would stand and give a case if he disagreed with something. He was removed in May of 1939, and Molotov put in his place. And similar situation with Ribbentrop. So Ribbentrop is both propelled into senior office, essentially because they will do what their masters tell them without interfering and without contradiction. So it's very peculiar that these two actually end up putting their names to one of the most infamous treaties in history, because they are effectively non-entities. But their role is that they are the cat's paws of their masters.
I think one of the very intriguing aspects that you work out in the book is that the alliance, the pact, actually went way beyond the sort of traditional imperial carve-up of Central Europe, which had been a theme, of course, for decades, if not centuries, particularly between Germany and the other great powers of the region. But it actually includes economic, even military cooperation, which I think raises a number of important questions. If in 1939 Hitler and Stalin, through Ribbentrop and Molotov, can agree on military cooperation, would you argue that they had no intention of attacking each other?
Mm.
At this point,
it's a good question. The assumption we have, where historians talk about the Nazi-Soviet Pact at all, and as I said just now, not many of them do, apart from merely a paragraph or a sentence, where it's talked about at all, it's generally talked about in terms of Hitler planning and playing this very long game. He says, "Well, I'll make a deal with Stalin while I can sort Poland out. That secures my rear so I can attack the British and the French." So it's reading history backwards is what we're doing. So we're imagining that Hitler's sort of planning this, almost writing it all down. He never did a stroke of work on it. He's got these desks in the Reich Chancellery. He's got another desk at Berchtesgaden. He never sat and wrote at any of them. He was a complete charlatan and dilettante who gave orders to his minions and they went off and did it. He didn't sit down and plan stuff. He's a chancellor. He's a gambler. The idea of him sitting down, making this long-term plan, this is what I'm going to do, and then in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, I'll attack Stalin, I think is a bit of a nonsense. He's making it up as he's going along. So Hitler does have, as I said, he's got the red thread that runs right the way through his own political beliefs and the wider beliefs of the Nazi Party is anti-Bolshevism. They have this antipathy towards the Soviet Union and everything it stands for. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he is duty-bound to attack Stalin in June 1941. He's making it up as he's going along. He's getting around the problem of Poland in 1939. Poland is stubbornly resisting all of his blandishments, all of his threats. It's stubbornly allying itself to the British and the French, and it's standing in Hitler's way. So he thinks outside the box with the help of the Foreign Office, and he says, "Well, we make an arrangement with the Soviets, and we can carve up Poland together, job done."
But what about
that's as far as he's thinking.
What about Stalin, though? He's not an improviser.
This is the other point. I think we are misconstruing both sides. So we imagine that Hitler has this long-term plan, which I would argue he doesn't. And Stalin, the idea is, or the conventional logic is, that all Stalin is doing is he knows that Hitler wants to attack him, and all he's doing in 1939 is holding him off. So it's a defensive arrangement. He said, "I'll just hold this man off, like a rabid dog. I'll hold him off for as long as I can while I rearm, so as to better be able to meet that attack when it comes. That's the conventional narrative. Again, it's nonsense. There's no contemporary proof for that at all. So what Stalin seems to be doing, there has to be a certain degree of wariness, even fear of Nazi Germany. They can't seriously have believed that the Nazi threat is gone. But there's also Stalin sensing an opportunity. He's fed up with the Western powers anyway. So collective security of the 1930s is a dead letter. That didn't work. The Western powers signed the Munich Treaty with Hitler. So he says that, well, the collective security is dead in the water. So I'm going to fend for myself. I will get the best deal I can out of this rabid dog. And as it happens, Hitler is offering him all of the territory that Russia lost after the First World War. Baltic states, eastern Poland, northeastern Romania. So he's giving him all of that territory that Russia effectively wanted, Russia stroke Soviet Union. And at the same time, add an ideological aspect to Stalin's thinking, which I think is crucial here. Stalin gets his two enemies, which are the Nazis and the imperialists. The grand imperialists, the British and the French, are seen in Marxist-Leninist terms as just as big a threat, if not more so, to communism than the Nazis are. So he gets his two primary enemies fighting amongst themselves. So as far as Stalin's concerned, the signature of the Nazi-Soviet pact is win, 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 all the way down the line. It's actually, from his perspective, a stroke of genius. So I think we've traditionally got this the wrong way around. We have Stalin acting in a sort of unideological way, and we have Hitler acting in a very ideological way, or a long-term planning way. Hitler's actually making up as he's going along, I would argue, and Stalin has much more of an ideological aspect to his actions than we've traditionally understood.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift the focus away for a moment from the dictators and look at the people who had to live under the Soviet sphere of influence as a result of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. In your opening remarks, you mentioned that up to 1.5 million Poles were deported, that political opponents were arrested en masse. And if we look at something that might actually strike us as bizarre today, that when the Germans invaded the Soviet-occupied territories in 1941, they were welcomed as liberators by the populations of East Central Europe. Of course, that changed quite quickly. But does that mean that life under Stalin was even worse than life under the Nazis?
It's a very interesting point. Again, we are sort of bombarded, certainly those that read popular history, we are bombarded with horror stories about German occupation, wherever it is, whether it's Poland or France or anywhere else. And I wouldn't gainsay a word of that. It would have been horrific, particularly to be Jewish or oppositional or a socialist, a communist, under the Third Reich. It was not fun. What we know a lot less about collectively, and particularly readers of popular history, is what life was like under Soviet control. And actually, the occupation of the joint occupation of Poland, and it is collaborative between the two, between 1939 and 41, is an opportunity to juxtapose those two occupation regimes. And what's interesting is that Poles and Polish Jews are undecided at the time as to which one is the best place to be. They don't generally have information. It's not like now where you can sort of even switch on a radio or look on your smartphone and find instant information. Then information is very much at a premium. Little more than rumours in most cases. But there's a famous scene in one of Andrzej Wajda's films, the film Katyn, which some of you might have seen. There's a famous scene in that film which supposedly happened. It's one of those sort of apocryphal images of trains crossing each other over the then Soviet-German border in central Poland. And groups of Polish refugees who have got out of Soviet-occupied Poland, who are shouting to the refugees in the other train that's going the other direction, who are refugees who have left Nazi-German-occupied Poland. And they're saying, They're both saying to each other, what are you doing? What? Don't go there. It's terrible. And they're both shouting that to each other. So both sides were horrific, depending on who you were. So the Nazis impose a hierarchy, effectively a hierarchy of race. And if you happen to be at the bottom of that hierarchy of race, most notably Jews, gypsies, you are in trouble. You'll be deported, you'll be expropriated, you'll be moved out. You'll be moved initially to a reserve or to a ghetto, and you'll be left there to moulder. They haven't yet decided yet on your ultimate fate. That comes in 1941 with the beginning of the Holocaust proper. But there's every chance that you could die before that from typhus, from random violence, whatever it might be. So there's a hierarchy of race in the Western German-occupied zone. In the Soviet Eastern-occupied zone, there's a hierarchy of class, where if you are a merchant, if you are a landowner, if you are a nobleman, if you are a teacher, if you are a professor, if you are a member of the establishment in any way, you are at the bottom of the heap and you are in trouble. And I'll just correct one point in your question where you talked about political opponents being persecuted in the Soviet Union or under Soviet control. It wasn't just political opponents. The list of people who were potential opponents of communist control was enormous. It was effectively anyone that wasn't a completely blemish-free industrial labourer or a peasant. Anyone else could be considered suspicious. And that extended to family members of people who were suspicious. And this is why you get to this figure of potentially 1.5 million. We don't know the true figure deported from Eastern Poland because it wasn't the records are not properly kept. But it was done on a family basis. So if one individual was a local judge, for example, he would certainly be deported, but his family would be as well. And they'd be deported to the wilds of Siberia. I just want to read a little bit, if I may. Just this is the what was known as the Serov instruction. This is the list that the Soviet Union gave out to the NKVD, to its equivalent of the SS, Gestapo, which was a list of all of those categories of people who were considered suspect and therefore ripe for deportation. The list goes from A to N, and A alone is as follows. All former members of anti-Soviet political parties, organizations, and groups, Trotskyists, rightists, social revolutionaries, Mensheviks, social democrats, anarchists, and the like. That's A. Right? It goes on. And it goes on to completely unpolitical categories. For example, members of the Red Cross. That could be a potentially life-threatening condition under Soviet occupation. Philatelists. I'm not joking. Philatelists. Speakers of Esperanto. Again, I'm not joking. They're on the list. And the thing is, to the Soviet mind, the Stalinist mind in 1940, knowledge is potentially dangerous. So if you're a stamp collector, you have knowledge of the outside world. You might have knowledge of languages. You might have knowledge of which countries where and are they democratic or whatever it is. It's knowledge of the outside world. It's profoundly dangerous in the Soviet mindset. So you see this list, it's not just a political opponents. That's A. We're going all the way down to N.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, one of the similarities is obviously that both the Nazis and the Soviets tried to decapitate the Polish elites. One striking difference, however, it seems to me, is that people are not. I'm not suggesting that living under Stalinist occupation was pleasant in any way, shape, or form, but they are not primarily persecuted because of their race.
No, that's true.
Because the communist Russia, the Soviet Union, is what some historians have called it an affirmative action empire, in the sense that the hatred is class-based much more than ethnicity-based, and that from Lenin's days onwards, they tried to incorporate the various population groups that lived within the growing borders of Soviet Russia. So here I would see a major qualitative difference in the kind of persecution that we experience.
Indeed. I mean, the other point to make is that although Germany is not yet explicitly in its exterminatory phase, the Soviet persecution is also not exterminatory. They're not sort of earmarking a particular class, if you like, for extermination. They are earmarked for deportation, which in some instances meant the same thing, but it's not quite the same as the horrific biological racism of the Nazis. It is not quite the same thing. But I think this is, it's an interesting point, this idea of comparing the two, which for a long time has been controversial. The idea that we should actually make a comparison between Nazi Germany and Stalin's Soviet Union. For a long time, that would result in shrieks of horror. And I think now, with the distance that we have between ourselves and the events of the 1940s, I think the immediate political passions of that time have lessened somewhat. I think it's a comparison that we should start to try and make. It's a very valid one to make, I think. And I don't really make that comparison. I make it perhaps by allusion and by juxtaposition in the book. I can't not, because if you're talking about Poland between 1939 and 41, you have to talk about experiences on both sides of that, as they called it, the boundary of peace between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. I don't go into that direct comparison, but I perhaps tee it up for others to follow on. But I think it's a valid comparison to make.
Mm-hmm. Just one last question for me before we open up the discussion. I'd imagine that the reception has been rather different in different parts of Eastern Europe. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about, the Russian response compared to, say, the reception in Ukraine.
It was a big hit in Poland, as you'd expect. I went and did some press and so on in Poland and was overwhelmed, actually. It was quite astonishing. It was quite a big noise, sold very well. There are rather more sort of vehement and sort of rabid voices in Poland that would say that I haven't gone far enough, which is interesting. Certainly in the Baltic states, it went into all three Baltic states languages. It went into Romanian, Slovak. So it's obviously been something that Central Europe is keen to read about. Mm-hmm. This is very much their own sort of history, which has been very gratifying, actually. And the response has been very positive. Less so Russia. Russia under Putin, it's very interesting, actually. Some of you might have noticed that, I think, 2-3 days ago, Putin gave an interview to one of his supine press agencies and again started talking about the Nazi-Soviet Pact. Again. He's done it a few times. He seems to, almost like Ken Livingstone and Hitler, Putin seems to have this sort of political Tourette syndrome where he blurts out things about the Nazi-Soviet Pact. And the usual line is, try and sort of render it harmless. And say, well, of course, it's what were we supposed to do? And of course, the British and the French, torpedoed collective security and so on. So it's the standard argument, actually, that the Soviet Union gave to try and justify its own actions, even from 1941 onwards. Stalin's first speech on the subject, which actually comes in July, where he talks about being forced to make this arrangement with these hyenas and jackals and so on. And he makes the same argument. So they're always trying to sort of render this episode harmless in their own history. But it's very curious that Putin seems to be coming back to it over and over again, almost as if it is, like a sort of a scab that he, every 6 months, he feels he has to pick at, which I find quite peculiar. It is almost, as I say, it's almost like a political form of Tourette's. It's interesting. There was a contract signed for Ukraine. I think Ukraine is, as we know, is in the process, and it is a bloody and will be a long, drawn-out process, of detaching itself from its sort of Russian sphere. There was a Ukrainian contract signed, which unfortunately fell by the wayside because of economic pressures, but it seems the will, at least, was there to sign the book. I think on that point, there is still a tremendous difficulty, particularly with this period, in terms of archival access. And in Russia, it's almost zero for Western historians, Western researchers who want to look at subjects like this. You don't really have a cat in hell's chance getting into a Russian archive, which makes life rather difficult. So actually the Ukrainian situation, where Ukraine is, as I say, detaching itself from its Russian connection, that I suspect and I hope will provide, in future years, will provide a boon for Western historians. Because I suspect that a lot of the archive, the central archive in Kiev, has material that's copied from Moscow and has been probably done in triplicate whenever it was done. And I suspect that Kiev will provide, in due course, will provide some really important insights into a subject which is still really shrouded in a large degree of secrecy. So I'm hopeful that Ukraine will shed a light in that respect.
Unfortunately, I think we've come to the end of our time. Before we all leave, I'd like to thank Roger for coming here and for answering all the questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. To hear more, please subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also follow us on Twitter or visit our website, dublinfestivalofhistory.ie, where you can sign up for our newsletter.